House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:20 on February 15th, 2012. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We've got Representative Miller, Representative Thompson, Representative Holmes, and myself, Chair Olson. We have three people that are out of town working on ANWR, so they definitely have an excused absence. But today is a special day, at least for me, because I've seen the what we're going to be doing already. And we have two really special people in the room, and I'd like to bring them up to the front table, and they know who they are. But got Captain Carter Whalen, who's the president of the Alaska Marine Highway Pilot or Alaska Marine Pilot Association, and Captain Pete Gray, who anybody that was watching TV for the last few weeks probably saw him on the news every night, because Captain Gray was the Marine pilot on the Russian tanker that made it into Nome. And you're probably wondering why we brought them here today, and it's for a very good reason, because like a number of organizations, their board or commission will be coming up for us for a sunset review next year. We bring everybody back, and it can be anywhere from 4 to 8 years, and find out what's going on, what they're doing, and things like that. But several of the people that are on the board are also up for confirmation this year, so we thought we'd take advantage of both of these gentlemen being in town, and more importantly, to for the members of the committee that don't really haven't had any experience with Marine pilots or live in the interior and probably don't have Marine pilots. It'll give you a little bit more information on what they do and how they do it, and it's going to be pretty informal until we get to the second half of the meeting, which will be the veterinarian bill. But on this half, anybody on the committee is free to hopefully not interrupt them on a regular basis, but if you have a question, address them directly, and they'll respond to you. We can save times by cutting out some of the formalities that we typically have. But I think we'll start with Captain Pete. Can you give us your name and affiliation for the record?
Hi, and everybody.
I'm going to let you introduce the gentleman sitting next to you because of the relationship. We have both halves of what happened on the way to Nome. We had one gentleman that was in Nome and one that was on the vessel, and I think they were the only two that spoke English during the whole trip. But welcome.
Thanks for having the two of us here, folks. So I'm Pete Gray. I'm one of 10 members of Alaska Marine Pilots, and our district runs from east of Kodiak out to the end of the Aleutians on up to the Canadian Arctic border. Captain Whalen's the president of Alaska Marine Pilots, and as most everyone knows, we had the opportunity to participate in the fuel delivery to Nome. And it was, for me, you know, my part as we go through this, Carter was on dispatch, and I was the actual pilot of record on the Renda. And together, at least for our component of what I like to coin as a team effort on behalf of a lot of people who participated in this mission, I'd say we had a lot of fun. And it's particularly satisfying, having done something like this with the amount of risk that was involved, to be able to come here after the fact, and it turned out really good, because there were so many times that it could have turned out bad. And a lot of good things have come about by doing this, accomplishing this, and I think there's a lot of good things still in the offing that are, I hope, will come about, and we can get, you know, we'll talk about some of those things. But generally, pilots are invisible what we do. Out of sight, out of mind, ships come and go, and that's a good thing, because when you hear about pilots, it's generally in a negative way. Something happens, there's a catastrophic event, and pilots have to get out in front and explain why that happened. And when we do what we do right, you know, you don't see it. Why ships come and go, no worse for the wear. So to have been involved in something like this, to where the opportunity to fly the flag a little bit about our profession, what we do when we're invited to or asked to participate, and some of the things that will come about by that, that's a rare opportunity. So I'm grateful to be here, and I think, Carter, you'd echo some of those same sentiments. Huh?
Yes, Carter Whalen, Alaska Marine Pilots. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate the invitation, the opportunity to be here with all of you this afternoon. On a number of levels, this operation to deliver fuel to Nome was reflective of the unconventional nature of pilotage in the far western region of the state. As you may or may not know, there are three pilotage regions in the state: Southeast, Southwest, and Western Alaska. We're the largest geographic area, but we're the smallest membership. By the nature, the extreme nature of difficult weather conditions, combined with a lack of infrastructure, we see things not on this scale, but things you won't see other places in piloting. And this was an example of teamwork at a level that I've in my my career I've never experienced before. When you take the Coast Guard, the state, you take the best and the brightest, and in a very unconventional, outside the lines, if you will, unscripted scenario, to accomplish something that, frankly, many of us involved from the early stages had many reservations and doubts if in fact it could be accomplished. And echoing his sentiments that we're all thankful it had a happy ending. I think everybody involved learned a great deal from this.
I have a feeling we have a lot of people in Nome that are extremely happy that it happened too, as well. And in fact, I know we do. We've heard from a number of them.
But one of the questions that have been asked of me by a lot of folks is, how did I get involved? Why were you the pilot? And I volunteered. I wouldn't have missed this for the world. And I think that speaks volumes about what's happening in the Arctic, the opportunity to go up and be involved in the new challenges that are going to open up there, particularly at my age. You know, I mean, there'll be a lot of new, younger people joining the profession of piloting and shipping opportunities up there. But so I volunteered. And even in its darkest moment, and there were some dark moments, some challenging on that bridge of that ship, when I was unsure how it was all going to turn out, I still never regretted it, that I'd made a decision to be all in, and all in I was, and there was no going back. And I like to characterize, as I talk about the challenges, there are generally four categories that were difficult hurdles, if you will. They were environmental, meaning working in winter conditions, not just winter conditions, but the dead heart of winter, with an ice pack that was growing 15 to 20 miles a day at its edge, cultural differences, procedural, and mechanical. And each one of those I could go into great detail, but for me, probably the most challenging of all four of those was the cultural challenges. And that was being in the middle of attempting to bring communications to a fruitful point between the Russians, and not only the Americans, but a branch of the U.S. military. And I can't describe to you how two most unsimilar people with different mindsets are, and to try to get them at the end of the day to close the gap so we could be operating two ships, in one case within 90 feet of each other, and the one ship going full ahead. So that required a lot of communication, a lot of trust, a lot of patience, and over the course of 10, 12 days we managed to get there. There were some other difficult challenges in terms of, when I say procedural, I speak to the issues of some of the hurdles the Coast Guard had to overcome, administrative and parameter keeping limits that they had imposed on themselves. And I like to say at the end of this mission, and I hope at some point the Coast Guard will testify, and they could probably say it better than me, but I don't think they rewrote their playbook. I think they wrote a playbook, because they had never done this themselves, escorted a commercial ship of this nature through these kind of conditions for this long. And it required them to close station, if you will, to a couple cables and 10 knots. I remember the first couple days of the trip, one of the watch officers said to me, "Captain Gray, there's not an icebreaker in the U.S. fleet that maintains station less than two cables and at 10 knots. It's not going to happen." Well, 2 days later, 3 days later, it was happening. It was happening 18 hours a day. And so the focus required on both sides, from the Renda and the Healy, to accomplish that and do it safely, took a lot. Mechanical, one of the things that happened within 8 hours of leaving Dutch, the Renda's engine developed valve issues, and it required the ship to shut down one of its cylinders, and they were going to shut down the plant. And this happened in a sea state 8, meaning close to storm force conditions, 50 knots, 30-foot seas, And when I found out about this, I recommend this is not a good idea. I reminded the folks aboard what happened on the Selang IU, and to go dead ship in these conditions, this close proximity to Dutch Harbor, is not a good idea. They disagreed. And so we had one of the first disagreement of many between that point and Nome. But I got on the radio, and I had a relationship, or was developing a relationship, with the captain of the Healy. And what we said is, if we needed to talk about something a little dicey, we'd go to the barbecue. So we went to the barbecue. I picked up the satellite phone and explained the situation. And a couple hours later, we were anchored safely back in Dutch Harbor, and they were able to effect repairs. So that I use as a first example of one of the mechanical hurdles we had to overcome. And then there were several subsequent issues with the engine of trying to operate her in what's called the critical range. Medium-speed diesel ships have an area of where the RPMs have to pass through a range that, as the ship speed tries to catch up with the engine speed, it rattles and shakes. And generally, when you're just going through water, you transit through that region, that area, pretty quick. But in ice, it doesn't happen that way. So because of trying to keep station-keeping parameters, if we went over the red zone, we'd be going way too fast. If we went under, we couldn't move. So we were operating in this zone for a long time. Sometimes we'd be in the red zone 50, 60, 100 times in a day. And it was killing the ship. And we had to do some stuff to resolve that issue, and we did. We came up with a number of maneuvers I called carving. I don't know if that's even a term, but we would fall behind the Healy, and when we got too close or we thought we were going to hit them, we'd pull off into the ice this way or that way. Anyway, we were able to close the distances. So what did I miss? We had cultural, mechanical, environmental, and what was the other one?
Procedural.
Okay, so pretty much. Anyway. Your turn, Carter. Go ahead.
We've probably gone on long enough. We can. Did you want to go on to some specific questions?
No, I can toss a few out. What was the quality of the Renda and the crew?
I'll let him speak to that.
A lot of you probably read the blog I was able to communicate, and I took great enjoyment. The Russians are a big-hearted people. They're great, but they don't have a lot. Every Russian ship I've ever been on is very Spartan. It doesn't have very many creature comforts. Three times a day is bread and borscht, but I'm Hungarian. I like borscht. I have to say, and I guess I described it, it's a grinding existence. A testimony to their ingenuity, I think, was proven when they lost their plant. And you don't go to the Napa Auto Store to get a new valve when your engine breaks down in the Bering Sea. And what he did was what they did is they took the old valve and ground or welded a lip around the edge of the valve, got out the grinder and some goggles, grind, 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 look, grind, grind, until it fit. They seated it, and we went. And that valve held and worked all the way to Nome. So it's a testimony to you work with what you got. And but the ship itself, one of the blogs I put out, I described as an example, the sleeping quarters. You know, that the mattresses were made in the hard and flat factory in Siberia. It was tough. But when I went to sleep, it was after being up for 18 hours, being on the bridge. So, but they did have one creature comfort. And I have to say, they had a sauna that would knock your socks off. 150 degrees, and they had this great big maple leaf thing where, you know, you'd sit there and the crew members would beat me on the back and I'd beat them on the back. And I have to tell you, going from 150 degrees to minus 60 is quite an experience. And I walked out and I'm watching everybody go up, where are you going? We're going on the back deck. What? So I walked out on the back deck, minus 60. And I tell you, the sweat on your arm would just crystallize and go poof. And you know, you couldn't stay out there very long, just long enough to feel your appendages start to tingle and back down to the sauna. But that was one of their creature comforts that they had, was the sauna. I enjoyed myself. I mean, like I said, it was a great little ship. A lot of the criticism about the ship was everyone was sold a bill of goods that this ship could complete this voyage without the Healy. Absolutely could not, no way, get anywhere. The Healy was what was instrumental. The ship wouldn't have been able to go 10 miles in these ice conditions. It was underpowered for the job. But what this ship could do was it could withstand the pressure in the ice. And about the second day, we got caught in a particularly nasty ice ridge with a great deal of compression. And you'll see a video where it shows some of the ice forcing against the side of the ship, and the ship's not moving. What's happened is the ship's gotten stuck, and the ice is compressing, and it's pressing in. The ice flows are moving, and it's stacking up alongside, and you'll hear some noise in the background. Amplify that noise you'll hear in this video times 10, and that's what I heard. It sounded like people were beating on it with a huge tom-tom on the side, and literally, when it first happened, I thought the ship would be crushed. I said, no ship can withstand this kind of punishment. And it lasted for about 5 minutes, and then it stopped, just dead quiet. And I remember turning, and I asked the interpreter, I asked the captain, is this normal? And the captain says to me, cool as a cucumber, well, this is normal for abnormal. That pretty much characterizes a lot of the voyage. It was abnormal all the way. And I have to say, speaking of this captain, he was 30 years old. I had a little apprehension when I first met him in Dutch. Russians have a mind of their own. They don't always do what you say. In fact, they very rarely do what you say. They do what they think they should do. But I got to know him pretty well. And he was kind of like the Michael Jordan of ice navigating, with the nerdiness of Bill Gates. But what he did lack was time and tide under his keel in terms of he understood the ice, he understood the mechanics of everything to do with ice, the dynamic of ice, but the overriding issue of the mission of what everyone was trying to accomplish was absolutely lost on him. He didn't get what the big deal was. And in fact, one day he asked me, pilot, how many people live in Nome? And I said, well, 3,500. He goes, 3,500? You must be kidding. He says, if this was in Russia, we'd let them freeze to death and come back at the end of the winter, and if they were alive, we'd give them their fuel oil. I mean, that's how it is in Russia. It's a little harder. So it's really unfortunate that the master himself was not able to come ashore in Nome and meet and other people get to know him, because there was a great deal of frustration on the other side of the ship about who they were dealing with here. And this gentleman I had the opportunity to work with, I learned a great, great deal. He took the time to explain every decision he made, why he wanted the Healy to do this, and then his frustration when the Healy couldn't do it, which he didn't understand because he's used to working behind a Russian, and this is what they do. This is all they do on icebreakers. And they work in proximity a couple hundred feet, and Russians aren't shy about going bump into things. That's why whenever you see a Russian ship, they have lots of dents on them because they get close, and if they hit each other, no big deal. But the steel on the side of a Russian icebreaker is 4 inches thick. So the Healy obviously had different sentiments about that, and the first time we came close to hitting them, they got a little upset. But we worked those differences out, too. But I speak highly of this master because he was very skilled, and I wish him well. And I wish, as the story's told about the Renda, it's unfortunate that people were never able to hear from him and his perspective, because I think a lot of what happened out there was the man had incredible patience. That's what I'll say. In spite of a lot of the frustration, as he taught, if you will, the Healy, what we need you to do to make this happen, it slowly never lost his cool. Every day in and day out, just working. And, when I knew I was in the presence of a guy who knew what he was doing, that they were in the ice and I was worried about getting crushed to death and things were bad. And he shows up on the bridge for the first time without his shoulder boards and all his paraphernalia that captains wear. And he had flip-flops on and shorts. And he sat down up at the helm there, and we proceeded to get stuck about 10 times that day. And from my perspective, boy, this is bad. But from his perspective, in his element, totally. So, anyway. I could go on and on and on. Best voyage of my life. Best voyage of my career. Most challenging voyage of my entire career. Because what it required for me to reach down on my toolkit and utilize some things, my people skills, if you will. And it also, at one point, we were asked by the Coast Guard to become a liaison and a principal line of communication between the Healy and the Renda. And that required, on a whole bunch of levels, to intervene in the business of the ship, the business of navigation. And generally, we are limited to 3 miles. And so to step over some boundaries and on a number of levels to do what I needed to do to get the job done, fortunately, it all turned out well. But if it hadn't turned out well, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to sit here and but it did. It worked well. And I like to look back. There's two things I like to say about this that I, in terms of an ask that I see that, that opened up my eyes. One, I think the Coast Guard's spot on when they ask and make the case for icebreakers. Because I think, whereas there may not be any more tankers to known in the winter, there's going to be a lot more ship traffic, commercial traffic in the future through the Arctic. There will be a lot more activity associated with oil and gas exploration. And as a result of that, there will be situations that will require assistance with icebreakers, whether to protect life, property, marine environment, emergency. And I think it would be wouldn't bode well for the U.S. if we had to defer and use other assets from Russia or Canada, or worse yet, the Chinese. We should have our own assets on station for when that day comes and be ready. And the other point I like to make is that these situations requiring, you know, exercising our sovereignty, our authority, if you will, are going to happen again. And whether it's a pilot on the ship or a Coast Guard guy. Incidentally, when the ship left and departed, the Coast Guard put one of their own on the ship. And one of the primary reasons for that was so that they could trust and verify what was going on the bridge of that ship. In order to exercise your sovereignty and to come up with the authority to do that is, I believe, this country should ratify UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea. Because absent that, we don't have the sovereignty to weigh in what happens on the bridge of a ship. And we have much to lose, particularly in the future, when other countries' vessels that are less than optimum than ours and don't have the same manning requirements. Just another example of a procedural, if you will. When we were talking about going through the ice pack, and we originally thought it was a couple-day trip, the captain, the Healy and I were talking to the captain, who would stand watch? And the captain said, I'll stand watch. And I said, well, you and who else? He said, me, just me. And so the master, and this is what they do in Russia, he would have sat up there for 18, 20, 24 hours a day with no relief. And you can imagine his state, how he would be once we got to Nome. Not very well. So the Coast Guard then, we came up with a plan that we would knock off and we would actually get some sleep. So that's just a small example of exercising some of your sovereignty or what you need to do to make sure the operations that are taking place in your backyard are conducted safely. And to do that, you know, I'm an advocate that there needs to be an independent set of eyes aboard the ship that's independent of the economic activities that are taking place.
That's a tough act to follow.
I turn it over to you. Any more questions?
If the committee has any questions right now, ask them, but I can guarantee you're going to have some after we watch the short tape. But Representative Holmes?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, the questions I was going to ask, I think, have been addressed, and I look forward to having more questions afterwards.
Yeah, I think three of mine got addressed just in the last 2 minutes.
Exactly.
Why don't we start the video, and I had the opportunity, I will admit, I've seen this once. I could watch it a whole bunch of times, and I believe there's a longer version on the internet. This one's relatively short, but definitely worth seeing.
Coast Guard icebreaker Healy, was referred to here in the Coast Guard dock. That's our plan now is to bring the anchor into Dutch Harbor proper, drop the anchor, and up to Port State Control, after which the clearance muster, take to the Delta Western fuel dock, put on another 500,000 gallons of gasoline. If all that goes well, we're going to meet the anchor now.
Yes, Captain, please just continue to proceed inbound toward the Dirt Falcon, and then we'll board you upon arrival.
In the ice, and we're stuck. And maybe a meter of ice, or stuck fast in a solid ridge of ice. And it's the Healy up there. She's coming back, try to break us out. A difficult start for what's going to be a 250-mile journey yet ahead of us. Number two now, and we were within a half a mile, and things are going good. Captain, it's good? Okay. All right, here we are, stuck again, big ice ridge. She's piling up, she's almost on the deck, but Healy's out back around. Well, here we are, about a mile further than where we were, stuck again. Here we are, in the middle of the Bering Sea, stuck, 17 miles off Nunavak Island. Healy has just made a pass around our starboard side. Ooh, here she is. Holy shit, he's...
Sorry.
It's a good practice for her.
Good practice,
yeah. She was saying, hey, I risked danger in the ice twice.
That is freaking scary. Yeah. Macau? So tell me what's been said.
Fine?
I'll give it to you,
Sebastian.
Why do they not agree with those terms?
They agree with the terms, they just don't want to do it.
Why not?
Because it's not safe.
Lots of frustration over here.
What was it? Up to two tables and with average speed of 8 knots.
That's a good one. What part don't you understand?
The track line ahead of us is where Keeley has just gone. What you'll see is the track has come closed for the first 200 yards ahead of us. Beyond that, it is still open with what the hull imprint footprint of the Keeley's hull left. So what this is demonstrating is that in this particular ice floe, right here, the compression forces are shoving everything together, and out there, the ice is different, although it appears uniform on the surface, it's allowing it to stay open.
Okay, we can see it close a little bit, and we're going to bring it back up to speed. We're coming up past 7, 7.5, so keep her coming.
We're doing something the Coast Guard's never done, ever. Yesterday, the Coast Guard does not do escorts at 10 knots, ever. Here we are. Sally, this is unbelievable. Ever. It's not in their playbook. It's no one ever does it. This is a historical first for the Coast Guard. Bravo on you. So, just showing an ice ridge. This one's so hard that the paint is actually peeling off onto the ice. Same thing we had this morning. We're getting crushed. The ice on our forehand side is stacking up against the side of the ship. Yeah, we're right now, we could move an inch if we wanted to. Look at this stuff. 3 feet thick. Paint from the Healy. Look at the Healy. Grinding and crunching. It seems like the two ships have found rhythm. Working in harmony. Speeds are adjusting up and down. If the Russians working on the Russian side, the Americans on the American side, and nobody in between. This is poetic. This is history.
After 7 days of fiddle farting around, we got her dialed in. The Admiral's over here, the Commander is over here, and we got her dialed. Yeah. Oh no.
You're the biggest optimist I have ever met.
The red tanker that could is doing it.
Right. Okay, just so you know where we're at, we're using our old tracks here to the starboard as relief. You should see us putting cracks in them as we go. So that should open the ice and keep it open for you a little longer.
Okay, there you go. Sounds good.
And match your speed at 7.5.
7.5 knots, we've gone up to as much as 10. 8 knots is the ooh-la-la speed at 2 cables, 450 yards, 500 yards. We're in our rhythm, we're in our beat. Healy's got her groove, I'm following right behind you. Beautiful morning. The only debate is who sung the song, Here Comes the Sun, Richie Haven or the Beatles?
Both. They're supposed to record, I didn't record them.
What?
We're about 20 miles from Nome, and we're going about 7 knots under our own power. We're coming to the end of the run here pretty soon. This is the fastest the run that has gone under our own power in the ice for the past week. All right, here I am in Nome, just got daylight, and I'm just walked off the brow of the ship. Pretty cool morning. No pun intended, I guess, huh? Morning fog, sun coming up, beautiful. Come to Susvies. Vehicles are almost 40 years old. They were made. One Susvie. Number two Susvie. That's how they get back and forth off the Healy.
Sounds
going literally. I can see the church steeple, and it's not over until, you know,
until we park it.
Until we park it. So my apprehension, my guarded optimism didn't go away one iota until the orange marker that she put in the snow, we pulled up right there, all stopped, and that's when the moment for me. And you know, I have to say, Edward, two times in my career I felt such professional satisfaction, accomplishment. One was when I graduated from the Maritime Academy, and that was a 4-year stretch, and that was, and this one was when we got here, all stopped.
It was a week long stretch.
Yeah,
yeah.
A week long stretch.
Yeah, sure was.
I think that's it.
Yeah. First question.
I have a question. Near the very beginning of the film, when the ship was, I know very little about shipping, going through what looked like very heavy seas, and someone on the tape would say, "We're rolling."
Yeah.
I couldn't tell if they were talking about the ship is rolling or they were rolling film and recording it.
The ship,
some of both?
Rolling. No, we were rolling.
All right.
Big time. You caught us pitching, but there was some rolling where we were taking significant green water. And that's when they wanted to shut the ship down in those conditions to repair the engines. That's when we were in it. And so you could, and actually did. They stopped the engines just to demonstrate to me that, see, we can work in this. And I'm thinking, easy for you to say. Wonder how the engineers feel about this decision down below.
And I can only imagine that carrying liquid as, you know, your cargo would make that kind of condition even worse.
There's some free surface. And so once you get, what happens is a dead ship will go into the trough. And so she does start rolling. Mm-hmm. And with the free surface moment, so you could get significant, very significant action. So it would have complicated the repairs. Again, the gentleman who was making the comment that we can do this, he's never been to sea. He had an economic interest solely in this thing, and time is money, and we don't need to go back. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there were enough other people that disagreed with him. And we did, and it was an easy 2 hours. Coast Guard came back out, checked it off, and we were back underway.
How far up does District 3 run? Is that run Beaufort M, Chuck Chee?
Region 3 exists, runs, as he said, from Kodiak, the Alaska Peninsula, Aleutian Islands, Bering Sea, Bering Strait, all the way to Chukchi and Beaufort to the demarcation line with Canada. So it's the largest geographic region of any pilotage area that I know of that exists, and as I said before, we're one of the smallest groups.
And, you know, just because it's probably one of the most unconventional regions in the U.S., if not the world. And one of our biggest challenges is working with limited infrastructure and logistics of trying to get around from A to B. And all of these areas, we see work, you know, obviously the wintertime, with the exception of what you just saw, we do see work in the shoulder seasons at Kevalina, at Red Dog, the mine. And we have been having cruise ships across the top. I think our first cruise ship was in 92 or so, but each season one or two will go across the eco cruise ships. And as of late, Nome is getting considerably busier. Port Clarence is becoming a gas station, if you will. Tankers will go in there with regularity, park themselves, and a variety of the different tugboat companies will have ATBs, and they'll siphon off a certain amount of load and take their fuel. Or ships will come in there and fuel up. It's a lot easier than coming to Dutch.
One other comment. You know, we saw a lot of on this video about the Marine pilots, but really we were, and Captain Gray and our association was very one small part of a team effort, a cooperative effort that included the state, the Coast Guard, Harbor Master in Nome Joy, and there's the list goes on and on. But we've said, I think in 07, when everybody started to focus their attention and their gaze farther north with the receding ice pack and the lee sails and the Chukchi and the Beaufort, that It will take a cooperative safety net to mitigate these risks, not only within 3 miles, but the state does have a vested interest in what goes on at miles 4, 5, 7, 12 from the coastline. As you can see, if a tanker is disabled 11 miles north upwind in gale force winds with 1.3 million gallons of product aboard, there's I took the phone call from one of the representatives that why was it reported that we have to shut the engine down? That's not in the spirit of a cooperation. They kind of came down on me, as they did Captain Gray, and said, well, this is in the spirit of cooperation. This needs to be vetted, corrected, and then we can proceed. And that's one of the many small bumps along the road, and every day was a bump in the road, but eventually...
You know, it is the most unconventional pilot jury, just by sheer size, if you will. And Carter mentioned earlier the three separate economic engines in our state, particularly on the waterfront. Southeast is cruise, south central is oil, and out west is the fishing industry. But that's shifting. We're seeing a paradigm shift from a fishing-based economy to what will probably be within the next decade an oil-based economy if exploration continues forward in the Arctic. And when we started piloting out west in the early 90s, there was no law. It was wild and woolly. And trying to develop the safety net, if you will, with we have a number of things like the emergency towing system we now have in Dutch Harbor and port parameters for what you can and can't do given certain conditions. It took a long time to get our arms around, if you will, this big geographic area to provide some measure of protection, if you will. The same challenges ahead of us as oil and gas comes into our region and starts business that we are going to once again have to reinvent ourselves in a very unconventional way. And part of that is when we sit down and convince people that, you know, some of this stuff, a lot of this stuff's going to happen outside 3 miles. Well, wait a minute, you know, the state generally, the jurisdiction only goes out 3 miles. Well, that may be so, but you're going to have significant risks taking place that need to be mitigated outside of 3 miles. And this is anything but a conventional area, and it has to be looked at, if you will, in many respects, outside the box. If we didn't look at this thing outside the box, this project we just did, we would have never got to Nome. And so a lot of the talent and the different agencies that came together, and you know, I've worked with all these agencies, as you all have yourself, I'm certain. Generally, they work in opposition to each other. It's not a well-oiled machine. And to have done what we did, where everybody brought the best of what they were to the table and made it happen, we like to see more of that, and it's going to be necessary to safely bring in the Arctic, if you will. And we've made the case in along the way that we'd like to be part of that, and we liked it. And as an example, we were part of this mission, and I think because we were, we helped with its success.
What's our most pressing need as a state? Icebreakers? I mean, it's obvious that we're ramping up up north and that somebody's going to have to assume responsibility. And I don't see the federal government stepping up, at least at this point in time. So, I mean, that pretty well narrows it down to either us or the Russians or...
Well, the pressing need is to recognize, I think, that there's a world of wealth in the Arctic waiting to be harvested, if you will, probably the wrong choice of words. And if we want to exercise our sovereignty, there's a number of things that we need to do as a nation. And looking at the construction of icebreakers for that day 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 15 years from now, makes sense on a whole number. It makes sense on a homeland security level. It makes sense in terms of protecting the environment. It's a ratifying that. And then, in addition, when we finally do go up there, having independent oversight of some of the commercial operations, the high-risk operations, rather than just leaving it to people who answer to nothing but the shareholders, to me makes sense, particularly because you hear time and time again, we have to do it right in the Arctic. We can't get it wrong. If we go up there and mess up, we're not going to get another chance at it. So I think some extra precautions, having the equipment up there and the right kind of people will pay dividends in the future.
Yeah, regardless of where you land on the issues of protecting the Arctic or extracting the resources, either way, ratifying the law of the sea treaty and protecting that sovereignty, that exercising some intent to oversee will benefit all sides, no matter where you're at, where you fall on that, whether it's resource development and extraction or simply just protecting what you have. Ratifying that treaty goes a long ways to in both of those regards.
No question. Currently, I'm assuming, since you mentioned it, the icebreaker and or any other icebreakers, if we had them today, they'd be stationed at Dutch Harbor. Is that correct?
We did have the Polar class icebreakers. We had a couple. The Coast Guard is better to speak to this than the pilots, but a couple of recently decommissioned, if I'm not mistaken, the Polar Sea and the Polar Star were actually based in Seattle at the Coast Guard base there and would spend the summer seasons up north.
So if the icebreakers are stationed that far away, let us just say there is an increase in shipping through the Arctic. So now we're off. Yeah, you know, off the North Slope somewhere, and there's a problem of some sort, and an icebreaker needs to respond. How much time are we talking about before they can get there?
That would be, if we had icebreakers, they would be on scene during periods of activity, I would imagine. But again, that's really not our area of expertise.
Well, wait a minute, it is our area. I'm a taxpayer, and I expect it to be up there stationed on scene all year.
That's right.
Pretty much, yeah. I think if we're going to pitch in and see it happen, that they do need to be closer, and they do need to be up there. And Dutch Harbor is a good port for them to be in. So like they wrote the playbook for this scene, they'll probably rewrite the next playbook for some of those kind of questions and concerns, so, I'd hope.
Yeah, and this is I won't hold you to any of this, just an opinion question. You think we need a deep water port somewhere on the North Slope or the North Coast of Alaska?
You want me to answer it?
Yeah, go ahead, Captain Gray. you've done a good, great job so far.
Yeah, yes. The question is where, and yeah. As you ask people, their answer is generally tied into where they hail from.
Yeah.
And so that needs to be looked. And I have some strong opinions about what logistically and where the best place for a whole variety, particularly from a mariner's perspective, where that port should, I should say ports. And I'll be quite frank, I believe it's between Port Clarence and Nome. Both of them have the facilities. Port Clarence is protected in all weather conditions. That becomes not as suitable when things ice in, unless you've got icebreakers. And, you know, when I looked at this operation, as difficult and hard as it was, is with icebreakers, I don't see any reason why not in the future, a decade, 2 decades from now, you couldn't be hauling lead and zinc out of Red Dog in the middle of winter. They do it in Russia, and they do it. It's not a big deal. They just go up, they've got the equipment, and they do it. So we could do the same thing in our Arctic backyard if we had the right kind of equipment. And between Port Clarence, Cape Spencer, the old Coast Guard station there, and the facility that exists in Nome, the infrastructure in Nome, the airport, I think personally, you know, focus and look at that. The idea of an open roadstead for a deep water port that's exposed to the Chuck GC, you know, some of the other places that have been proposed have that issue. And I've been at Red Dog for the past 20 years, and when it kicks up, you don't want to have a port out front there.
Mm-hmm. I'd like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Representative Paul Seaton from Homer, who coincidentally represents Captain Gray.
Hey, Paul.
And it's totally informal. Throw out questions. Join us in asking questions. We're not doing it. I mean, we're just keeping the dialogue going to give us more time to ask questions, but feel free to weigh in.
Well,
I know you want to volunteer Homer for the homework for the icebreakers, but
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good to see you, Pete.
Roger that.
And it's I'm sorry I missed the previous part of the presentation. I'm glad we can catch up with it on gavel to gavel, but. I appreciate you being here, and I'll just listen for right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good.
What other issues do we have in your region? What should we be looking at besides oil and gas development, more activity?
You know, a more overriding issue in terms of some events, this event, the Renda, which I think demonstrates what can happen when pilots are invited to participate. but also the recent event in Italy, what happens when there aren't pilots, illustrates an issue of why having the safety mechanism, a pilotage, if you will. And when the, I believe it was the Coast Guard was asked, could this happen in Alaska, they said probably unlikely because we have pilots, and that's a difference between here and the Mediterranean. But having pilots isn't the complete answer. We have a system, and for the most part, our pilotage system operates out of sight, out of mind of everybody, and that's a good thing. It means it's working, but it's something that just shouldn't be taken for granted. It needs to be examined and looked at, and like any ship of state, occasionally, you know, it should be hauled out and dry docked and the barnacles scraped off and looked at. And there are things in our system, and I won't go into it here at this point, that should be looked at and scrutinized closely to make sure we're prepared for the future. Because if we don't have a solid system of pilotage underneath us, when the big hiccup comes, it'll be quite embarrassing, expensive, and the consequences of a marine accident today far away what happened in yesteryear just because of the what happens, pollution, loss of life. So, you know, my pitch to everybody is don't take our pilotage system for granted. What we do is important. It's valuable. And it needs to be looked after and watched and handled carefully.
Right. And echoing what Captain Gray just said, and I say this with a great sense of humility, that mitigating the risks in our maritime, the coastal regions of Alaska with the lack of infrastructure and extreme conditions, it's a work in progress. We come away with that reminder from operations like this and from our daily work in Region 3 that mitigating the risks, considering what we have to contend with, it's a work in progress. It never, you never reach a point where it's comfortable. You always need to adapt, and this was a good example of adapting and overcoming. And
well, wasn't it, what was the saying? We hosted last year the West Coast Pilots Conference, and it was great to be able to show off our state and have our peers here come to a anchorage. And what was it? Vigilance is the
price of safety.
The price is constant vigilance. It's the price of safety.
You know, I'm going to do something I've definitely never done before. We've got people in the room that are here on a different bill, but we've had people that have been sitting here for the whole thing. If there's anybody in the room that would like to ask these gentlemen a question, just identify yourself for the record. I see at least one captain in the room, but I won't put her on the spot by asking her directly. But anybody in the room that would you know, has sat through this, we've obviously missed a lot of things, but feel free to throw a question or two out to them.
I would just caution the audience that if you want the long answer, ask me. If you want the short answer.
Nobody's picking up. I'll go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that, you know, I also represent Seward, and they have the simulator over there and now the fire training and all. Are the facilities and the courses that are offered in Alaska substantially adequate to maintain the levels of expertise and recency and all that are needed by the pilots and for training of and certification of pilots?
Paul, that's a good question. We're hoping that Seward will become a world-class facility in terms of ICE training. One of our pilots has been dedicated, John Scheibel, with developing that program. They've invited Avtec. Kongsberg is one of the leading experts in simulation and ICE, and we hope that the ICE training class will be up and running by the end of this year. We anticipate it'll be a couple week long course. And in other venues too, with the training of the tanker captains and the tugboat, it continues to be utilized by the pilots. Great facility. Yeah, the answer to your question is yes.
Okay, and just following up, if as the pilots find if there are pieces that need to be added to that so that we can train within Alaska and certify and keep everybody up to date in Alaska, would you make sure that the Pilots Association comes back to the legislature and lets us know? Because we don't want something to happen, and we don't want to have to be sending our whether it's ferry pilots or any other captains outside for training that we could be offering here if we have the right program.
Roger that. One of the Southeast pilots, Captain Bob Winter, is on the board of directors. And so we get periodic reports, and we'll get one tomorrow at our pilot board meeting about progress made with new training programs that are being implemented there.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I found this all really fascinating. This is most of our conversation's gone into what I would say is more the cutting edge, pushing the envelope type of projects. And as we're talking more and more and more around here about what it's going to take to work in the Arctic, this has been really helpful. But while we have you here, I was wondering if you could also tell us a little bit more about sort of your bread and butter. What is it that makes up most of your workload?
Why don't you start? I'm going to grab some water.
traditionally, in Region 3, it's been the fishing industry. Pollock A and B season, we're well underway with one of our busiest times of year in western Alaska right now with the pollock fishery. There's peacod, there's a number of ground fish, rock sole, yellowfin sole, that fill in some of the gaps. Also, there's a summer, fall pollock season. We have crab, a couple of crab seasons, Bristol Bay, Togiak, we have herring. Then we have Kivlin in the summer months, the ore ships that come and go there. We're now seeing ATBs. Crowley is bringing ATBs into Hagemeister and the Togiak area, Port Clarence, a couple other places the last couple years, and they're going to again this year. They don't, I guess this is kind of off the subject, but they don't require a state pilot, and they've voluntarily employed a state pilot on all their ATBs in Alaskan waters. That's an interesting side note.
And if I could butt in on that, Kivalina is the port that services Red Dog, so it's ore and fuel, I think, probably.
Our tanker comes in at the beginning of the season, fuels up the tank farm, and then it's ore ships until almost October. July, usually.
Freeze up.
Yeah, until freeze up. July 4th, July 8th, last time I was there, I think we started bringing ships in on the 8th, the last of the ices. We have to wait for the ice, but it's fairly predictable then, that period of time, and then until the freeze up in October.
One other thing that I would add about what we do, that it's unconventional. A lot of the places we have, these facilities were built for 60, 80, 100-foot tenders. And years ago, and we take ships alongside them. And we don't have the benefit of tugboats in a lot of these places, so we do old-time ship work with anchors, and we do a lot of anchoring work. Another component of what we do, I like to describe ourselves, our involvement in a lot of places, as a conductor, if you will. We'll go to, let's use Bristol Bay, and we'll basically shepherd in 9, 8, 10 trampers and park them between Naknek and Clark's Point, and stay on station while they're there. And effectively, when I say we're the conductor, we will basically weigh in when ships should separate, when they should come together, and just kind of oversee the operations of what everybody's doing. When I mention a conductor's role, if you will, a lot of the work we do isn't alongside a dock. It's ship to ship. And so when you're doing ship to ship work, and there's a couple of other vessels involved with it, somebody needs to be in charge. And so our role is not just suited to the actual getting, you know, hard star report, the lines, but, again, serving in more of a much larger capacity of this is how the operation will take place, and here's what we should do, and we should stop operations when weather conditions or tide conditions do this. So. And that's a little, you don't see pilots performing that kind of a role. Another one that we find ourselves in the middle of is emergencies. Quite often in Dutch Harbor, when ships break down or something happens, not any place else in the world, a salvor's called in or a tugboat. But we have been principal participants in what I described earlier as the emergency towing system. And last year we had one of our pilots go out on the Tor Viking and assist with when they took the tour the package out, and it was a canola tanker that had lost its propulsion, and assisted and helped bring the ship back through the various passes back to Dutch Harbor. So, you know, for pilots to be involved in, you know, the emergency aspect of ship handling, that's only peculiar for Western Alaska. So those are a couple more points about why, you know, ours is a little bit more than just bringing the ship to alongside the dock and some of the work that we do that you might not normally see in some of the other districts about around the United States. It's different. It's just like this mission that we did this time. It's Carter mentioned earlier, what we do because of where we're at, a lot of it's different. And it's going to be even more different when all the activity heads up north. And, you know, generally, you know, ships come into port, but it's my guess, you know, my prediction, that a lot of the port activities you'll see will happen well outside 3 miles. There'll be platforms and there'll be the need for vessels, many vessels, to come together. You know, when we began our campaign about pilots' participation in the Arctic, it was in 07 when Shell first showed up. And they were planning to send their flotilla at that time up to the Arctic, and it included several icebreakers, a tanker, and a drill ship. And they were going to go up, and before they actually got into the Arctic, go to Kotzebue, and they were going to all get together and lighter and take fuel. And we do that. We bring ships together, as I said, all the time, the Yokohamas, where and what and how, and we were going to be involved in this. And then before the operation actually happened, we were told, well, we won't need you because we're going to do this operation outside 3 miles. And so that raised the question with us then, and still does, if it's not safe to do this kind of operation inside 3 miles, why is it safe to do it outside 3 miles? And so we thought that's a horrible way to start, you know, entry into the Arctic with the kind of risk that we're assuming, to just say, well, we'll just leave it to luck and hopefully it'll all work out and thank you, but we don't need you guys. So we've used that as an example then and still use it now, that if you're going to have this kind of operation with vessels operating in close proximity, you have pilots when they do that in a harbor, why wouldn't you do it when you're out beyond 3 miles?
And, Mr. Chairman, when I referred to it as bread and butter, I didn't mean to oversimplify. I have spent just enough time out on the ocean to understand there's very little bread and butter about anything they do. But
no, I have been following the Marine pilots in Cook Inlet for a number of years, and basically the pilots get on in Homer and take the LNG tankers up for the urea cargo vessels up to Nikiski, load them, and then come out back and jump off in Homer. And to the best of my knowledge, I don't think we've had a major incident in Cook Inlet. We had one that didn't have a pilot involved, ran aground. Glacier, help me, Paul. Do you remember that one?
Glacier Bay.
Yeah, the Glacier Bay.
Years ago. Yeah, they anchored it and drifted over a rock.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
it tore off.
While we've spoken to answer your question regarding the economic engine that drives our region, I think one other aspect that is worth mentioning is the variety of vessels. While the economic engine is fishing for the most part, with a few other things mixed in, we have quite a variety of vessels that we service. We have the trampers, the refrigerated cargo hold 120 meters that come, you know, 4, 5, 6 at a time. And we actually, because there's nowhere to go to get on or off or no infrastructure, we'll ride these ships through the Aleutians in the winter and the summer for days, weeks at a time. We've had pilots 28 days out in Kiska. A sea bag, it's like going to sea. It's not like you're on for an hour, you dock the ship. Then in Dutch Harbor, we have the 970-foot container ships, APL, Maersk, and the D7 Horizon Run, where you have a fixed number of tugs at fixed horsepower, but you have an infinite amount of wind, it seems at times, to contend with. So that's another area of what we do. We have some smaller cruise ships. So there's quite a variety. Our work takes us a lot of different places. Some places we don't see for quite some time. There's a lot of places in Western Alaska that used to see a lot of shipping activity that don't anymore. It changes, and it always has changed. So,
you know, one other component to about out west is Unimak Pass. You know, it's at the frontier of the Pacific Rim shipping that goes back and forth. That sees close to 5,000 deep draft ships each year transit through there, and a lot of those, you know, end up coming into Dutch for one reason or another.
That's something you're going to see here, and you have probably have heard a lot about already. We work closely with coastal communities in Western Alaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt in particular, with not only the emergency towing system, but now she's working on her own initiative, her own effort. It's not something that necessarily the pilots have driven, to get a mooring system that we use. We anchor these deep-sea Great Circle Route ships when they're partially disabled in the winter. We find refuge, and with the holding ground we have, but to have some kind of an engineered mooring system that that we can put these ships on where we don't have to have one of our two tractor tugs stand by, that's just another example of the cooperative effort that exists to mitigate these risks. And there's still a lot to do.
Well, again, I'd like to thank you gentlemen very much, not only for coming today, but for your service to not only the city of Nome, but to Alaska. And I know it's been an eye-opener for all of us, and I am glad I got to see it twice. And it's on the Internet. I don't know what's the best way to find the full tape.
Okay.
Gibberish.
How to make Conrad read this. It's YouTube / 68 key. In fact, call Conrad.
Yeah. We can put it on a website or something somewhere.
Yeah, thanks again, gentlemen. We're going to
briefly
adjourn.
Briefly
recess.
Annette. You got that, didn't you, Annette?
Yeah.
I guess so. We're back on the record. It's 4:30, and we have had a scheduling error. I will plead guilty to being responsible for it. We're going to be the bill that we originally had scheduled for the other half of this meeting was House Bill 251, Practice of Veterinary Medicine, and we're not going to have enough time even to have it read across, but we've devoted all of Monday's Labor and Commerce meeting to it. And if it takes longer than that, we will take as much time as needed. But the first half of this meeting ran a little bit longer because I was under the mistaken, I made a mistake, and I thought we had till 5:30, and we don't. So with that, we will adjourn. And anybody that's out there online, I apologize.